Our second reading today comes from the book of Corinthians, and I will be reading chapter 1, verses 10 through 25. So listen now for a word from God. Now I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you be in agreement and that there be no divisions among you, for that you be united in the same mind and same purpose. For it has been reported to me by Chloe's people that there are quarrels among you, my brothers and sisters. What I mean is that each of you says, I belong to Paul, or I belong to Apollos, or I belong to Cephas, or I belong to Christ. Has Christ been divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that none can say that you were baptized in my name. I did baptize the household of Stephanas. Beyond that, I don't know whether I baptized anyone else. For Christ did send me to baptize, but to proclaim the gospel, and not with eloquent wisdom, so that the cross of the Christ might not be emptied of its power. For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, God decided through the foolishness of our proclamation to save those who believe. For the Jews demand signs and the Greeks desire wisdom, but we proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength. This is the word of the Lord. This thing's huge, bigger than my car. So today we have a letter from the Apostle Paul to the church in Corinth, which is a very large center of commerce in ancient Greece. Corinth still exists. There are many ruins of ancient buildings that still stand there. It's apparently relatively close to Athens. I've heard it's about an hour's drive. And it is located in the Isthmus of Corinth. And for the record, that was the first time since fifth grade that I have used the word isthmus. And I'm really glad you were here to share that with me. We think that this letter was written somewhere around like 53 CE, which means it's been about 20 years since the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now it is my habit that every time I preach on one of the epistles, I remind everyone that the epistles are letters Paul has written, and they are to specific communities in specific contexts, because they have written to him with their problems that they're facing specifically, and they've asked for his advice. And they are not Paul's random mailed editorials or an ancient version of a blog post that he sends out to his followers. There are twos and froms. So this is my caveat, because I never want us to accidentally take a piece of correspondence that was meant for a particular place and a particular people and apply it to our own spiritual communities mistakenly. Women being silent, the church. And for that reason, I don't like to preach on Paul's letters often, but whenever one pops up in the lectionary that really is like a piece of universal wisdom for the church, I feel like the Spirit really wants me to speak to it. Especially, say, in a completely hypothetical situation, if you went to the Vanderbilt Divinity School website, because they have the most mobile-friendly version of the lectionary, and hypothetically, you forget that it also includes the Roman Catholic feast days, and perhaps you didn't notice when you click on September 14th that it is the feast of St. Helen and the Holy Cross, which has completely different readings than the standard Sunday ones, and you send those into the bulletin, and now you're stuck with some random strange verses when all of your colleagues get to preach on the parable of the lost sheep. So let's hear about Paul's letter. Back in Corinth, it was a really wealthy port city, and there were a lot of mix of cultures due to the number of immigrants, and it developed a reputation for not like quite a cliquey social scene, but among even citizens of the same wealth class, there were factions, and I don't know why, and I would love to read some research on that. But either way, it was just kind of ingrained in the people there that they needed to group up and decide who to include and who to exclude. Paul spent a year and a half living in Corinth, planting and raising up the church there. He's been gone from Corinth between 1 and 2 years, and it's still a very new church. They are working out the kinks, and they're not used to having leaders from among the congregation have to step up. They're having a hard time trusting these leaders, and the leaders are having a hard time forming healthy bonds with those that follow them. So Paul is writing to a group that can't even attempt unity right now because they're in competition among themselves and choosing the right leaders and the right paths that they need to follow. And after addressing some of the specifics of the conflict, he chastises them. I thank God didn't baptize the rest of you. Yikes. And he says that he was sent to preach the gospel and not with eloquent wisdom, which is noticeable because this is ancient Greece and persuasive rhetoric was an important skill. And convincing people was often more about how you made the argument rather than the point you were trying to make itself. So Paul tells them, hey, y'all listen to me. You're writing me for advice, and I write like a country bumpkin in Koine Greek, and I can't even make an argument in the classical language like the rest of the scholars. I'm not the draw here, and you know that. And if you acknowledge that this is about faith in Jesus, then deep down, you know that these other arguments about which preacher you want to follow are pointless. And as our favorite friendly theologian, Joseph Tribbiani would say, it's a moo point, a cow's opinion. It just doesn't matter. It's moo. Intellectuals, orators, lawyers, they do not hold the power of evangelism and conversion. That power belongs to the cross, which is, yeah, a strange statement because professed Christians would get it because it's a phrase that they're used to hearing, but as Paul points out, for the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, and has God not made fools of the wisdom of the world? For the Jews demand signs and the Greeks desire wisdom, but we proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. And Paul's not throwing around generalizations to make a point. He's right. To most of the world, this sounds nuts. Preaching the victory and holiness of a man who was publicly tried and executed as a criminal? Acting like watching a naked man die slowly with a mocking sign hanging above his head was some sort of holy experience? These crazy Christians want to share that with others? The man died. He lost. Game over. Move on. The Jews know what it means to be a people occupied by an oppressive foreign army. And then they reasonably point out that the Messiah was supposed to liberate God's people. He would have driven out the invaders, set right the wrongs, protected the innocents from the daily cruelty of the army. The Messiah wouldn't have just hung there and died. He'd have come down and fight and rain fire upon his enemies, and his enemies would have been our enemies. And or if it had been prophesied and necessary for him to die, he would have died an honorable, epic, inspirational death on the battlefield. He would have left a people inspired, rescued, and free, not hanging there in front of anyone who walked by. stripped of all dignity. I mean, that's almost blasphemous to suggest about the Messiah. There were no signs of power during the crucifixion. Doesn't it depress Christians to talk about the cross? The Greeks also think this is a really strange claim because, logically speaking, gods are more powerful than humans, are they not? And gods will do what they like, things that benefit them or to those they favor. The only thing more powerful than a god is a stronger god. But if there were only one god, then nothing could stand in the way of that god's will. A god would not be conquered by humans. A god would never allow himself to be humiliated or degraded. Therefore, logic demands the death and human weakness shown by Jesus disqualifies him from the pantheon of gods. The only acceptable explanation for the chaos in this world would be that there are many gods with many different motivations and desires, and that they are at war with each other. If there were only one, that god would rule and enslave us all to his one desire. Therefore, the speeches these Christians make are nonsensical and foolish. Paul's not having it. Paul doubles down. The weakness, the servant leadership, the sacrifice Christ made is through the cross. The cross is foolish to them because that's not the way that gods are supposed to be. They look to the cross to demonstrate force, and instead, it demonstrates love and strength. You can't find force or traditional acts of strength because Jesus was all about weakness, living into humanity, humility. This was all an act of love. And before anything else, you have to come to the conclusion that God loves us, because you can't understand who Jesus is without that. And yes, that does seem pretty silly and foolish. It is odd. But in what they call foolish, we know it is love, wisdom, and victory. The cross is power. It just looks different than what people expected it to. This is Paul. Paul writes that. And it's inspiring for me to read right now on a Sunday. I like Sundays. I'm in my hometown. Spent the night at my parents' house last night. They made me dinner. I didn't have to help with the dishes. My mom tucked in my girls last night so I could have a break. This is like a mini vacation. I'm feeling good. And right now I'm standing in my home church, and this sanctuary is super special to me and my faith journey. I was baptized right there 41 years ago, same font and everything. Got my first real Bible down there in the third grade. We all lined up and they gave it to us. 29 years ago, I stood somewhere in this area. It's kind of hard to tell because we used to have the weird stage thing with the ugly brown carpet. But the confirmation class all stood there, and we joined the church by making our first public confessions of faith. But I was 13 and thought organized religion was a sham, but, you know, I felt like you guys were nice people, and my parents made me take the class, so, you know, whatever. And then while I was home from college on a break 21 years ago, I was sitting in that same spot where my kids are when our pastor talked about God's love for like the 12,403rd time. But for the first time since my childhood, I actually believed it. Huge moment, right? In 2006, also home on a break, and right after the service, I shimmied between the pews, kind of where the sugars are, and walked up to this guy I knew was a visitor. And to be friendly, I put out my hands and I said, "Hi, I'm Kelly Updegraff. Nice to meet you." And he looked at me for a second like this. Then he looked down at my hand and back up at my face. And then he just turned and walked away. That's a core memory for me. I still laugh about that one. Because when he and I got married, it was also in this sanctuary. So this room, this is my God place. And I could stand right here for days and talk about God like some sort of theological filibuster. And it wouldn't matter what arguments anyone threw at me or how skilled of a debater they were. And if there was a question I couldn't answer, it'd be fine. You know, because God's going to do what God's going to do. It's all a perfect mystery. We don't need all the logic and answers. This is not who we are. We are people of faith. cross makes perfect sense. Those small-minded ancient Jews and those dumb loser Greeks back then with their tiny little boxes to try to fit God in. How sad. What a waste. Maybe this is your God place too, and I hope it means a lot to you and that you come here on Sundays because the Spirit gives you strength and comfort when you're here. And every time Holly does that transition from the offertory where it's kind of quiet and it turns into that da-na-na-na-na-na, that you feel that in your chest and your body leaps up with your heart. Maybe your God place is a special retreat center that you visit, or a cabin, or you take your vacation every year, the stage at your old high school, bookstores with comfy chairs, history museums, the columbarium where your favorite relative has found final rest. Perhaps it's any beach where you can walk barefoot on the sand, or St. Peter's in Rome, even though you only saw it once, that was enough to transform you. And at these places, you know or knew with every fiber of your being, the truth of God's love for you and the magnitude of Christ's victory over death. And we have God, people, a grandparent, a teacher, old friends, a niece, your mom's neighbor at the retirement home, just folks in your lives that every time you talk to them, you feel better because they make you feel like the world is a beautiful place. And they inspire you, and you are just filled with gratitude that God put them in your life. Those God people and God places are such a gift, right? Such sources of strength that connect us to our faith. Yeah. So great. But sometimes those holy places are far away and you can't visit them. And you'll never be able to afford another trip to Italy, can't even take enough days off to go to drive to the beach, and the special places you love get destroyed by floods or fires. The retreat center where you always felt God was sold to a fundamentalist group, and you don't want to support them. This or that place is too different now to bring any happy memories anymore. That other place is off the table because it's poisoned by memories of an ex-lover. Your family church becomes a shopping mall. Your special people die or get sick or age terribly. They suffer or they're in situations suddenly that make them totally different people. Or you have nothing in common anymore and your politics are so different you don't even want to be in the same room anymore. Maybe you lose your job and you have to move away from your friends. Maybe you're just lonely. Well, then we feel a little ambivalent about the cross, don't we? Maybe a little miffed. Worship feels like a waste of time for everyone at that point, no matter the church. You haven't liked the last two guest preachers. They move the time of the service, and it doesn't feel the same. The new pastor went up and put up a screen in the sanctuary, and every time you walk through the door, someone has a new favor to ask you, or a new committee that needs you on it, or a complaint that they need you to hear, and you are tired of it. Things are going wrong. The world feels off kilter. There are awful things happening, and you're helpless. There are wars and famine, slavery and oppression. There's just looming dread around every corner. You can't get your tasks done, and sometimes you can truly give it your all, and it's not good enough, and everyone knows you failed. And you can't function. And you're spending your last bits of energy just trying to make sure your kids are fed and safe. Maybe you have chronic pain and three doctors and $1,000 worth of copays later, you still got no answers. Maybe there's tension with your partner. That woman at your job who insults your work and spreads rumors in the break room has won yet another award or accolade, even though she openly steals other people's ideas. Meanwhile, someone you really like and admire has behaved badly, and you don't know if you're more angry or defensive or just sad. Should I be supportive or accusatory? And now traffic is backing up and your GPS isn't working and you've got to stop for gas even though you're running 10 minutes late already. And no, you don't want to type in your phone number for 3 cents off. No, you don't want a car wash. Why is the premium gas where the regular gas should be? Why is the gas coming out so slowly? Yes, I want a receipt. And by the time the screen flashes, cashier has receipt, it might as well say, there is no God, you naive fool. When you are low, yeah, the cross seems kind of foolish. When you all you have is capacity for rage, the cross seems irrelevant. When the world has pushed you down and then acts shocked that you can't get back up without tangible assistance like food, shelter, or money, the cross seems like a joke. Trauma and abuse turn the cross into a shimmering mirage. You're not even sure if it's real. Graves you are not ready to dig reveal a cross that flutters in the wind like a tacky decoration, and it's just annoying. And when a town on the news has to special order tiny coffins for an elementary school class, even the most stalwart believer might find themselves thinking, that cross is a dangerous lie. There are moments when it is so easy, so instinctual, to become a Corinthian Jew from 2,000 years ago and ask, what signs were there? Where was God here? Where is the salvation and the kingdom we were promised? What part of this had God in it? Tell me what I missed. Tell me like a 5-year-old. What was I supposed to be looking at? And then you tell me why, that if God is supposed to love and cherish me, why God wouldn't make it more obvious. God knows I'm kind of slow. We turn into ancient Greeks, trying to logic our way out and into theology with theories and language that by definition is supposed to be bigger than our understanding, and it doesn't work. Well, if God created everything, did God create sin? Why would God create sin, or was that us? And if God allows us free will to sin, what does that mean for our relationship with God and with creation? How can a God be all powerful and all good if God doesn't directly intervene when there's evil? We want this to make sense. No. I just have questions. Please answer them. Teach me, but also tell me where you're getting this information from and why I should believe it. So we all search for signs, while the greatest sign is God's willingness to bear our pain. We look for wisdom and logic from rhetoric, but the cross says true wisdom is not the brilliance of an argument, but a depth of love that holds nothing back. The power of a horrible thing like the death on a cross, which is a torture device, it proclaims that there is no place, there is no pain, there is no despair too deep that God's power will not reach it. The cross, yes, looks like foolishness, for sure, but it shows us a love that refuses to quit, a love that will not turn away, a love that will follow us all the way down into death, then snatch us with and then go to a new life. And that's hope. We cannot be separated from God even when we think we want to. Cannot be done. So what do we say when frustration, pain, and fear close in? What do we say in times of foolishness? We can only hold fast to Paul's word. The foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom. The weakness of God is stronger than human strength. That means we don't have to be ashamed of ourselves and our weakness. We don't need to cover up our pain with platitudes or pretend like we are stronger than we are. Our doubts and laments don't make us bad Christians. God knows this story is weird and confusing. And like Paul, we can celebrate that God does not require us to have eloquent wisdom. So that means that it's okay when you can't phrase your deep questions, or that you worry about things and you can't tell them to other people because they won't understand. And it's okay if you can't articulate your faith in such a way that it inspires other people. It's okay if your explanation isn't good enough for someone else. It's okay to be frustrated when someone on Facebook argues with you about your faith or the Bible or the decline of the mainline church or what's wrong with being PCUSA. And they can shoot out proof texts like Nerf darts, and they can phrase their arguments that sound like they're Alexander Hamilton in a rap battle from a Broadway play. And all you can authentically get out is, well, but this just doesn't align with the message of the cross. That's good enough, because we're not meant to have some amazing preaching power that we are given upon our baptism. God meets us in our stuttering, in our deepest suffering, in our highest moments, in our special God places, in the darkness where we think we are alone. God goes where we go. And we know we see power differently than the rest of the world, that power is a sacrifice and love rather than influence and success. The world admires all those things, but God's power is shown in sacrifice. We look to this thing that should scare us, that should remind us that evil is in the world, that there is injustice, and even the good perish. We look to that and we smile, and it gives us joy because the hope displayed in the resurrection on that empty, terrible cross does not rest on what seems reasonable or practical. It rests on love poured out for the world, and that love is stronger than fear, stronger than despair, and stronger even than death. And my friends, that is the opposite of foolishness. Thanks be to God.